Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I guess we could say that what we're doing on this week's show is we're talking to some of our favorite people.
Absolutely. three real dynamos of the field.
Oh, yes.
We might add.
Yes.
As you all find out. So if you're looking for strongly worded opinions,
yeah, we've got them.
we got them right here. And one of the strongest opinions of all is Darina Allen, all the way from the southwestern corner of the Emerald Isle, the Republic of Ireland, whatever you like to call it. East Cork, I think she calls it.
Yeah, I think so. So Ballymaloe is
an absolutely remarkable establishment.
Yeah. I mean, we've been there, and so when this book was really particularly, it touched all the right points with us, because we've been there and seen it all.
Yeah, but it's a new thing that Darina is on about, because it's not just about cooking, it's all about nourishment, how to grow it as well.
Yeah, her book is called Grow, Cook, and Nourish. Darina Allen, you've done it again. I can't believe it. Your latest book, Grow, Cook, Nourish, subtitled A Kitchen Garden Companion in 500 Recipes. It is a tome. That's what the word is created for.
Well, you'd almost need a wheelbarrow to bring it into the kitchen.
Yeah.
And the ridiculous thing with this is I really scored an own goal, because it's so heavy, and it's got 500 recipes plus all the growing information in it, but it's so heavy that the book club find it too expensive to post.
Yes.
So they couldn't buy it from me. So there you are. Now, how about that for an own goal?
That's amazing.
Now, you're using a football term here. You have to be careful, because Anne doesn't really know what an own goal is.
Oh, I see.
I do know.
But anyway,
it is.
I could have saved myself some trouble and had 100 pages less, probably. Anyway, there's a lot to say about the whole subject.
Yeah, well, this is the subject after our hearts. I grew up with, my mother was a fantastic organic gardener, vegetable gardener. And, I know the pleasures of having your own garden. In fact, I didn't realize how privileged I was, but then I look around and I see, although our daughter-in-law is finally catching on to this whole program, she never had this growing up, and it's an amazing thing. She tries planting a few things and has a lot of trouble with them. This book, how do you think it should be used? Because you don't sit down and read it cover to cover, but I've already learned some things, as I told you, from it. You have so much information. Describe how it's organized. I mean, it's...
First, I suppose the reason why I wrote it was because I've become more and more, and I think it's exactly the same in the U.S., I've become more and more concerned about the deterioration in our national diet over here, you know, since, say, in the last couple of decades, particularly. It's absolutely extraordinary. So many people have handed over the responsibility for their food choices to a few multinational food companies and also to the supermarkets. And, you know, so it's really, and we are here in Ireland, we also have an obesity problem basically, we are, you know, we're destined, if we keep on going the way we are, we're destined to become the most obese country in Europe.
Well, in the States, the last
something has to be done.
The last statistic in the U.S. is one out of every four is obese. Now, think about it.
Yes. So we have a crisis. I mean, a serious world crisis, and we know the problem. But it's very hard to fix it, because even if you know exactly what you should be eating, for a lot of people, it's extremely difficult to find nourishing, wholesome food. If there's a very good farmer's market near you, perhaps that's going to help. But the thing is that if one starts to think, well, maybe I could take back some control myself over the food we're eating and start to grow something, You don't, of course it's an advantage if you have a garden and you have a bit of space, but you don't, it's not even necessary. I mean, all you need, if you live even in a high-rise apartment in a city or something, you can still grow something. If you have a windowsill or a little table in front of the window, all you need is a container of some kind with some soil or compost in it, and then sprinkle on even some salad seeds or something like that, and then you need some water, you need light, you need a bit of patience, and you need some time. And so I know lots of people who grow all of their salad leaves on a windowsill in their apartments. You can grow spring onions, you can grow radishes, all sorts of things. If you have a balcony, then you can grow things in pots and on shelves and all sorts and so on. And then even on a fire escape, I think maybe that's illegal, but some people do grow things on fire escapes.
Yeah,
and then, of course,
so.
If you have more land, and so I know, you know, and also this, there's a lot of, sometimes I get quite heartened by the urban farming and gardening movement,
which is
a global thing now. So people are growing up walls, down walls, on roofs, on balconies, you know, on their sidewalk, you know, in the little strip of, I don't know what you call it, between the sidewalk and the road. Sometimes
nature strip.
Yes. I mean, all sorts of things. So, you know, and then suddenly, my goodness, they discover the magic of sowing a seed. And then when it germinates, it's so exciting, and then it grows into something you can eat. And by goodness, will you want to eat it slowly. And it gives you, you know, sowing a seed and growing something yourself, and you'll know this because I know you do it, it just ticks all the boxes, and it's much more than just growing something. You just suddenly realize that food just doesn't materialize on a supermarket shelf in a couple of days. That it takes 3 months to grow something like carrots or beets or something, and then you suddenly realize, well, there's something terribly wrong with our food system when I can buy, carrots and beets or something for less than a dollar a bunch, and you realize that wholesome, nourishing food can't be produced for that price.
Right.
And then it gives you much greater appreciation of the farmers and food producers and gardeners. You want to hug a farmer the next time you see them when you realize how much effort goes into growing some of our food. And also you're not likely to waste a scrap if you grow it yourself. You'll want to eat every bit. And again, you don't have to grow a huge amount of stuff. People think, well, I need a huge garden to feed me all year round. But you don't necessarily, because if you're growing beets, for example, you get 3 vegetables there. You can eat the beets, you can eat the stalks. We chop them up and cook them in a little boiling salted water, toss them in extra virgin olive oil and maybe add in some herbs or spices or something. And then also you can eat the leaves. So you've got 3 vegetables, where if you go to the supermarket, you only have 1. With the radishes, the leaves are delicious in salads and a little soup, as well as the radish itself. You know, there's so many examples of vegetables where you can eat many different parts of the plant.
Yes, and you're always on the right side, the correct side of sustainability. I love that.
Hey, Doreena.
Well, we can't go on with business as usual much longer with the way we're treating the good earth. I mean, I'm beginning to sound like the aged hippie I am, but each and every one of us have a responsibility, but it's the joy that you get from growing and the satisfaction you get from growing something yourself, not to speak of the flavor. And then it reduces your food costs, and you know it's not flipping sprayed out of its mind. You know, there are no pesticides or herbicides or anything else on it. So every bite of it is enhancing your health rather than doing you a damage, which so much of the food that we're eating nowadays is.
Well, we have an advantage here, some of our listeners, is we've actually been to Ballymaloe. And we've seen the incredible gardening. And how many students go through that school?
Oh, yes. Well, here at the Ballymaloe Cooker School in East Cork, the school is in the middle of an 100-acre organic farm, and we have extensive gardens, and then we have some chickens and pigs and Jersey cows for milk and butter, and we make cheese and all that sort of thing. And so Sorry, I actually went off on a tangent and didn't listen to the question. What was the question? How many students? Sorry, how many students? 64. Now, we operate the whole year round, but we have, we do three-month certificate courses in the year for people who want to earn living, you know, learn the skills to earn the living from the cooking. And there will be 64 students on that course. And we have one teacher with every six students. So we've got a very high teacher-student ratio, and they go out in the morning, of course, to the gardeners to bring in the produce. You've been here, you know all about that. They collect the eggs, and they, you know, the reason why students come literally from all over the world, and there are 14 nationalities here at the moment.
Oh, yes.
And that's not unusual, and it makes quite a difference to a little country village, to the economy of a country village. And we have romances and all sorts of things.
I bet you do, yeah.
The way to everybody's heart is through their tummy. But the reason why they come from all over the world is because it's a non-farm cooking school. And so they can learn and see how food is produced, literally from that much hackneyed phrase, from the farm to the fork. And now this is not a conversion on the road to Damascus. We've had the cooking school since 1983. And so basically we were always, this is always the way we were, you know, we ate the food from our farm and gardens and as much as possible from the local area. And then of course we do of course use some imported foods, lots of spices and all sorts of things, but we really cook pretty much all the time with the season because it's just, we have the food around us, this kind of food we use, and it makes sort of sense. And of course it's delicious, and the students,
the
main concern is when they leave here how they're going to get something like that. Well, you can get it if you start to grow some of your own food, and then maybe join up with a few pals and you grow three or four things, and then your friend grows another three or four things, and somebody else grows something else, and then you can all pool, you know, you can share some of the carrots and you can get some of their spinach back and so on.
Well, you have a whole bunch of tips on gardening. You make a great case for growing your own food. And then you also do something the tips are incredible here, not only on the growing, but on then using the produce.
Oh, yes. And of course, it's not only the, and of course, the recipes then, and also ways to use up a glass if you happen to have it. Also what to do if you have some little pesties and diseases and things. And so on. And then also, the most important thing of all is what it's a little section in at the beginning, vegetable or thing, on good for you. I mean, the whole raison d'etre for eating and for our food, of course, is to nourish us. So we kind of forget this. Nowadays, food has turned into such a commodity, the only thing that matters for the food manufacturers and so on is to make profit. The whole reason for food is to nourish us.
Yes.
And so it tells you good for you, and this is, I'm looking at the garlic here in front of me, and it says excellent source of calcium, phosphorus, selenium, and also contains significant amounts of vitamin C, B6, and manganese, and then naturally low in sodium, fat, and cholesterol. So, you know, and also that sounds all a bit kind of chemically technical, but then I'll tell you that it lowers blood pressure, is beneficial for your cardiovascular system. I'll mind you, garlic is amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it really is, yeah.
So that just happens to be the one in front of me.
It's turmeric.
And it's antibacterial and all the stuff. So it tells you why it's a really good idea to plant garlic. And here in Ireland, you know, you can go along to, well, anywhere, you can go along and you can buy a bulb of garlic, divide it into cloves, and now very soon you can put it into the ground, because we normally would say here, you plant the garlic, plant it the right way up, okay, and put it into the ground, and on the shortest day of the year, and then it'll be ready to harvest around the longest day of the year.
That's
and
good
I
idea.
Should really mention a wonderful, you have many, many wonderful things happening in America in this area, but one of the movements I always think is very interesting is something called Grow Food, Not Lawns. You know, sometimes people have a little. Yeah, isn't that good? Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Or even if you only have a little bit of backyard, well, of course you can grow in pots and all kinds of containers. I once saw somebody growing something in an old bath, and another one was in an old drawer from a chest of drawers. So, you know, even if you don't have much in the way of resources to buy special pots or something, just look and see what container you have and you'll be surprised what you can grow in it.
It's funny. Hold on, let me get a word in edgeways here. It's really...
Well, I'm the worst. Once I start, you can't stop me.
It's hard for you girls. Well, no, I wanted to share with you. My mother passed away when she was 95. And I think if I had asked her at age 94, did you ever have garlic in your food? And she would say, no, I never would have.
Absolutely.
When I started the
cooking school in 1983, garlic was still exotic and people would sort of say, oh no, it doesn't agree with me and so on. So gosh, we've come a long way since then. Right now, Irish people can't get enough spices and enough chili. They keep on saying more, more, more.
Yeah, no, that's amazing.
What I was going to say was she thought she'd never eat garlic, but she ate a lot of food in my house.
And you snuck it in.
I snuck it in.
And of course,
here is a second, just to give our listeners an idea. I'm going to call this a Bible of sorts. It's a total reference book for growing and using what you grow. But like here we have leeks. That's the ingredient. You explain about leeks. You talk about the varieties of leeks. You talk about how to grow, giving tips on growing leeks. Then you talk about how about container growing, harvesting, the pests and diseases, the nutrition involved, and then what to do with the glutton. That's my favorite one. I had a glut of Asian pears this year.
And
I got them made into a friend has a restaurant with a huge smoker for barbecue, but I had him, he's a crack bartender, smoke the Asian pears and make a cocktail.
Now that was great.
Yeah. And then you have in the kitchen. But after that, you then have all these recipes. And I want to point out that these recipes are not just how to use on an average. These are creative, wonderful recipes.
Thank you.
Yeah, they'd be good for any cookbook. No matter, I mean, a celebrity chef cookbook or anything. They're absolutely fabulous recipes.
Really well tested, because with a cooking school, I mean, we test things usually three times. And of course, if anything is funny about it, when it goes into the kitchen in the morning, the students find out immediately, and it then has to be tweaked.
Oh.
Well, we had both lunch and dinner at Ballymaloe, so we can testify ourselves directly. It's really funny. I don't know that I ever told you this, but I've told quite a lot of people. We drove from Dublin to Ballymaloe when we came to see you for the first time. And it's really funny. I remember thinking as we were driving along, although I never said anything, why are we driving 250 miles to go to this God-forsaken place in Cork?
Out in the wilds of West Cork, or East Cork, sorry.
And it only took about half an hour after we got there and we understood that we were in a place that was really special.
That's so nice.
Where there is immense dedication to everything to do with food and its preparation. And
this book, I mean, where else are you going to find a recipe for parsnip ice cream?
Oh, my God, that's so good.
Oh, you
have to try that.
Oh, yeah, I know.
It's so good. It's so good. Sorry about that. The other thing, though, the parsnip ice cream is properly good. You need to try that. And the other thing that I want to just to say is how important I think it is for people, if they are growing something, to involve, if they have children, to involve them in it, because a lot of people have a lot of difficulty nowadays with getting their children to eat this fresh vegetable, etc. But if you actually show them how to sow a seed and they grow it with you, they'll eat anything. They just love it. And as well as that, you're teaching them a life skill, which is so important. And they get so excited about their little things growing. And so that I've been very much wanting to encourage that through this book as well. And
you're actually, a big supporter of the edible schoolyard garden.
Exactly.
Yes.
And also, you'd be amused to hear that for this 3 years, research actually has gone into doing this Grow, Cook, Nourish book, because there are so many things that, as you can see, it's so big. But basically, for the 3 years, the working title for this book was For God's Sake, Grow and Cook. some of your own food. And my publisher wouldn't let me call it that. He said it sounded far too bossy. So anyway, but that's what it was always called, for God's sake, grow. And I feel so strongly. You know, let's take back a bit of control over the food we eat and not be seduced and duped, really, by a lot of the marketing of a lot of the highly processed foods. And, you know, so much depends on the food we eat, our energy, our vitality, our ability to concentrate, you know, and our health to a great extent. And so, but so if you grow something yourself, you know it's going to nourish you, and that's really, really, and your family. And of course, you're never going to have an allergy or any of those things that have now are such, I mean, so commonplace. And, you know, I'm 69 years of age now. When I was a child, I never heard of somebody being allergic or intolerant to food. So it's a symptom of how our food is being produced nowadays.
Oh, yeah, it's awful.
The maximum amount of food at the minimum cost. It can't be done. There's no such thing as cheap food. It's too expensive in health terms and all the rest of it in the end.
Now, you venture into less well-known plants, too. And also into something that, again, is close to my heart, is foraging.
Oh, yes. well, this, again, is sort of almost a forgotten skill nowadays. Learning how to recognize foods that are super good for you and super nutritious in the wild.
Yeah, and I wonder how you protect yourself if you don't really know what you're doing. Like some of these things, there's one in here that even I didn't know. Begin with a P. Physalis or something. I'd never heard of this. A herby thing, a wild herby thing that I never heard of. I mean, there are things in here that I don't know about, and I've been around gardening my entire life.
The interesting thing is that I can't say I would absolutely do this in Asia, but I would anywhere in these islands or even in the U.S., if I went outside the door, even in a city sometimes, if I'm anywhere near a park or something, I could go within 5 minutes of somebody's house and find five or six things to eat. You know, it could be dandelions or, you know, do you know what you have a lot, even in New York and some of the cities, you have purslane coming up through the
we have
the cracks.
All over our backyard, except Peter calls them sticks.
Eat it, darling, it's delicious.
I know, it's very nutritious.
And also very good for you. But there are a lot, now, I'll tell you why foraging is so important. And, I mean, I know people say to me, well, why would you bother? Because, you know, you can go into a supermarket and get anything you like and all that. But basically, there's the thing about the forage foods, the wild foods, is they haven't been tampered with in any way. And so they still have all their vitamins and minerals and trace elements in them. Whereas so much of the foods, the vegetable crops and the grains and all of that we now eat, have been, over the years, they have been adapted and so on, so that they have much less in the way of vitamins and minerals in them than they used to have, because they, just the whole emphasis is producing the maximum yield, and so often to the detriment of some of the nutrients. So that's why wild foods are so important, because they have so many tiny, minute quantities of different trace elements we simply don't get in the cultivated, highly cultivated foods, particularly the ones that are chemically grown. So that's why it's really important. And in answer to your question there, you know, obviously don't eat something you don't recognize and that you're not sure about, because, you know, although I reckon that a huge percentage of the plants around us are edible, much more than we realize. But nowadays there's really no excuse, because there are many, many very good books on wild foods and foraging. So there are some classes that you can join in. We do here at the cooking school, we do a foraging course in every single season. And every year it's oversubscribed. And then there's loads and loads of flowers you can eat as well. I don't dream of eating the flowers from a florist, because a lot of them would be, but a lot of them would be sprayed to death. But basically, you know, the flowers that you grow yourself or that haven't been sprayed, a lot of those are, of course, edible. You can sprinkle them over salads or decorate with them. I'm just opening the book here. There's cornflowers or chamomile, of course, we know, soporific, lavender, little marigold petals, or what you called, you have a different name for marigold, I forget what it's called in America. And
I think we call them marigolds.
Yeah.
Do you call them marigolds? And then things like primroses.
Yeah, that I didn't know you could eat. I'm surprised.
I mean, masses, you know, elderflower, of course, you know about, and all of that, Alexander's chickweed. Chickweed you pay good money for down in the on Union Square Market down there.
I know. We have all that wild in the backyard.
And, yeah. And, of course, dandelion's an incredibly important plant.
I was raised on that, but we had it. It was viewed as a spring tonic, basically.
Yes, of course. It's got lots of vitamin K and a very good source of vitamin K and calcium, potassium, and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, I remember your salad at the...
We already talked about the most beautiful salad in the world.
The flowers.
Hold on a second. Before we get carried away, we must make sure that people understand where they can get not only this book, Cook, Grow, Cook, Nourish,
but
any one of the umpteen other books that Dorina has written. And if you're inspired because you just would like to explore food, or if you're inspired because you want to become a chef like Dorina, what's the website?
It's called, and this will give you information about the cooking school too, Dorina at Cooking is Fun. COOKINGISFUN, one word, .ie.
Great.
So it's cookingisfun.ie.
Yep.
.ie. And people who might also be interested in an earlier book called Forgotten Skills, or of course, at the moment, my Christmas book seems to be flying off the shelves called Dorina Allen's Christmas, I think it is, or something.
Wow.
Half Ireland cooks out of it. So
wow.
Anyway, but this one's called Grow, Cook, Nourish. And you need a wheelbarrow. It's so heavy to carry into the garden.
Yeah, but it's the kind of thing you keep and you reference.
Dip into.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yes. And as I said, I learned a lot just even from going perusing it for the interview. So
yeah. We miss you. We miss you. We're going to have to come back and see you
again.
Oh,
you'll have to come and see us again. Yeah. Now, next time, fly into Cork Airport, and then you're only 35 minutes from us.
That's a good idea.
Dorina, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for this inspirational work.
Yeah, Dorina, I had a question.
Yes.
Myrtle.
She's in really good. This is my mother-in-law, Myrtle Allen,
yes.
And she's in really good shape.
Oh, great!
She is 93 at the moment, and she eats with a different one of us every night. And she's in very, very good physical.
Oh,
a short-term memory isn't what it used to be, but then neither is mine. So
no,
there we are.
Nor ours. Anyhow, well done, Dorina Allen, and it's just a magnificent reference book for everybody. Grow, cook, and nourish. Thank you, Dorina.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next guest is Joanne Chang, who we've been interviewing since she started her first flour bakery, and that was many, many years ago. And she branched out from that to her Meyer Plus Chang cafes.
The amazing thing is they now have 7 flour cafes.
Yeah,
all in the Boston area.
Meyer Plus Chang cafes, yes.
They also have a restaurant. And Christopher Meyer, who was Joanne's husband for these many years, who knew he was a chef? I didn't actually really know that.
Oh, well, then.
Joanne is kind enough to say this is really his book.
Yeah, well, it's called Myers Plus Chang at Home. So it's what they cook in the cafes, but also what they cook for themselves at home.
You're going to enjoy, I feel sure.
One of our most favorite chefs, Joanne Chang, and restaurateurs, I should say, baker, award-winning baker, and whatever. We go back a long time, Joanne.
Yes, it's been a while.
It's when you first opened your series of bakeries called Flour in Boston, and now you're telling me you have 7 of them.
We did have a big push last year. We opened 3 locations within a year, so that was a big push.
Wow. Oh, and how did you survive that?
Well, I'm pretty lucky. I have a really great team. I mean, everybody works so hard, and everybody was on board with the three expansions. And so we just kind of put our heads down, and everybody took their, you know, part of the pie that they're responsible for and just pushed through. And it was tough, but everyone did a great job. And now we've gone from, you know, 4 to 7 in a year, and it's been great. You know, customers have been really happy. We've been really happy. We've got a lot of great growth opportunities when you grow that fast. So that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, the book we're going to be talking about is really about your restaurant, which is Myers and Chang, which is the restaurant you and your husband own, with a really snappy executive chef, Karen Akunowitz, who has a wonderful background. And as the book is actually taking, we had interviewed you before about the restaurant and with recipes, but this is at home. So you're really turning it around and making it a cookbook for the home cook. Which, do you really think I can make these things, Joanne?
Absolutely. That was one of the biggest things we wanted to emphasize in writing this book, is that we didn't want it to be a coffee table book. We want it to be a book that you put in the kitchen and you start cooking from immediately. In fact, if you flip through the pages, you'll see that some of the pages have stains on them already. They've already been pre-stained,
oh, yes,
and pre-creased.
Right.
Yeah, just to give everybody a sense of, you know, this is meant to be used in the kitchen. And what we did for the testing process is we had home cooks take recipes and make them at home, and every single recipe has been tested by at least 3 different home cooks before we put
wonderful.
It in the book.
Now, yeah. That is a great advance, because I've worked on books where that was not done, and I can tell you I would be surprised if anybody managed to execute the recipes.
Right, right.
Now, to give a little background, your preface and introduction, you have your executive chef do one, and then there was the second one I was reading, and I said, you know, that doesn't sound like Joanne. I mean, it was the language, it was the tone, but the one thing that came through, and it was written by Christopher, your husband and partner, the thing that came through was what you're talking about is what a wonderful team you have.
Oh, yeah, that's so true. Christopher is a fabulous writer, and I've been trying to get him to write anything, even, you know, a book or help with the cookbook, and his additions to this book were monumental, and his writing the preface for me really kind of put the whole thing, pulled it all together, because it gave a sense of the restaurant as a whole, which is, you know, we want you to use this book, we want you to have fun, but we want you to see that the restaurant is full of spirit and life and a lot of energy, which is really what Christopher brings to the table. And, you know, he does a great job of explaining kind of the whole team that built the restaurant, and it continues to make the restaurant run. It's a really great, you know, I feel really, really grateful that I can work with all of these people. We actually just celebrated our 10th anniversary, and we just got 4 stars in the Boston Globe. So
oh,
it feels
wow,
like,
congratulations.
Thank you. It's just such a great tribute to every single team member who works really hard every day at the restaurant. It's a hard business, you know, and to get something like that,
I know.
You know, really makes it all worth it.
Well, another thing you did early on, I can't remember whether it's after the preface or before the preface, you have a great list explaining what all the ingredients are that are involved in your cooking.
That, yeah. Right.
And after that, I couldn't remember where it was. And a toolkit as well. So it's not like you can't get yourself equipped with all the stuff you need before you start working on a recipe.
Well, it's called How to Shop, and I have had this experience of going into an Asian grocery, and frequently you're confounded not only by the variety of unfamiliar products, but nobody speaks English when you're trying to figure out what to do. And you explain all of that, and now I must say it's a very long list of what you need to buy.
Well, the list of ingredients or How to Shop, you don't have to buy all of those things. We wanted to make sure that if you were reading a recipe and you were unfamiliar with an ingredient, then you could go to this section of the book just to learn about it. So not every recipe is going to obviously use every ingredient.
Oh, right.
And But we did want to make it comprehensive because just like you, sometimes we walk into the Asian store and we have no idea what we're looking at. And so we spent a lot of time, you know, working with my parents who go into an Asian store, and for them it's, you know, they grew up in Taiwan, so they know everything. And so I can just say, Mom, Dad, what is this? And they can explain it to us. And then Karen and I, you know, we've been working together for 6 years. The restaurant's been open for 10. The restaurant is right across the street from an Asian market that we visit probably 3 times a day. So we've gotten to really know kind of every aisle and every ingredient really well. So we wanted to share that with the readers in the book.
Oh, I think it's enormously valuable. I mean, you explain the difference between rice wine from someplace and rice wine from somewhere else.
Yep.
And rice vinegar and...
Well, you know, growing up, when I was starting out with cooking, I mean, I always loved Chinese food. I grew up on it, too. But all the recipes I got in these Chinese cookbooks only called for, like, 3 ingredients, and everything tasted the same.
Yeah, yeah.
And now there's all this variety. But you're also... your food is Taiwanese. And if I'm correct, Taiwanese... It's not just a single, it's a fusion of all of the different provinces and whatnot and districts in China. It's not just, and your book is even further. It incorporates influences from all over the place.
Right. So Taiwanese cooking really, Taiwan is a tiny, small island. So there's a lot of emphasis on seafood and a lot of fresh vegetables. And it's not quite as sweet as you might find in some other parts of China. But all of China, you know, to say that there's one type of Chinese cuisine is really inaccurate because, like you just said, there are so many different provinces, north, south of China. Like, the climate is different. Everything is so different.
Yes.
So we started off the restaurant focusing on Taiwanese food because that's my background. But we very quickly started adding on different parts of Asia, and even adding some things from around the world, making some fusion cuisine. And the real emphasis of both the book and the restaurant is just making dishes that taste amazing, that use the ingredients that are familiar to most Asian cooks. So not everything is true, strict interpretation of maybe a dumpling or a spring roll, but instead what we tried to do is make it a little bit more relevant to today's palate and understanding what you can access in the grocery store and what you might have eaten out when you've been out, and just taking it all and making it our own food.
You know, I was reading an article that said a fact that people tend to, in the U.S., tend to think of Chinese as a static cuisine, even though it's a classic cuisine. And
what
I've been reading is that the big chefs in China proper, all, even within their own provinces, they're into much more chef signature dishes and having their own voice and changing and updating and modernizing these classic dishes.
Right.
Is that true?
I totally agree. Yeah. Oh, yes. I think a lot of times, you know, we take these cuisines and we reduce them down to the 10 things that we're familiar with, and then that represents the cuisine. And yet, you know, you go into any cuisine, not just Chinese, but, you know, Italian and Spanish and Mexican and Indian, and we can all kind of rattle off the things that we know, like from our standard Indian menu. You know, there's chicken vindaloo, and there's, you know, the all the different breads and the naan. But really, if you delve into the cuisine, that's just the very, very tip. And I think even American cuisine, if you were to ask an Asian person or an European person, you know, what is American cuisine? And they might say meatloaf and potatoes or hamburgers and hot dogs. And sure, that's a part of our cuisine in America, but I think you could ask any chef, you know, what they think of American cuisine, and they wouldn't say those items.
Right. You know, we just got our first specific Taiwanese restaurant here in Pittsburgh, and I was amazed at how many hot dishes were on. I always associate that with Sichuan.
Oh, huh. That's interesting. Yeah, I guess Taiwanese food does tend to be a little bit spicy. It doesn't have to be, but I think, you know, it does get really hot. I think a lot of the cuisines that tend towards the spicy foods, get really, really hot. It's just a way to naturally cool yourself with the sweat. And so I know that my mom, when she was cooking food, I mean, I love spicy food, and I think it's in part because I grew up with my mom making everything really spicy. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
I'm really jealous about your mom's cooking throughout your childhood. That's no, I mean, I had a good cook mother, too, but she was Italian. But that was okay. It was Sicilian. It was good.
I liked your story about where's the rice.
Where's the rice?
Oh, yeah. Well, the funny thing is that you say you're jealous, but I was jealous as a kid of all my friends who ate what seemed to be, to me it was exotic, but, you know, it's more normal food, where I only ate Chinese food, and I was always wondering, you know, what everybody else was eating. And I remember when my parents would go out for a date and we would get, you know, a babysitter or something, they would buy Swanson's TV dinners for me and my brother. And that was like the best time ever. I was always so excited. And we would spend like hours in the grocery store picking which dinner, the one with the turkey and the mashed potatoes, or, you know, the meatloaf or the roast beef. Oh, we were so, so excited. Because to us, that was really exotic.
You're not old enough to remember this, probably, but what was the class of horn and hard art? I mean, what did you call that? They were called automats or something like that?
Automats.
I remember there was a horn and hard art on Broad Street.
They're bringing them back, apparently.
They are?
Yeah.
I mean, I was in Philadelphia for the first time in 1972, and there was a horn and hard art right on Broad Street.
I don't remember
which,
that
one. Which is long gone.
Yeah, it's long gone. You have a number of dishes with Italian origins, and you and your executive chef both have a very special place in your heart for Italian cuisine. And I asked you, like, why you were so fond of it.
I do love Italian food. If I couldn't eat Chinese food, then I would eat Italian. And I think there's a lot of similarities in how Italian food and Asian food just hit your palate. They're both really powerful cuisines with a lot of flavor and a lot of umami. You know, a very umami taste in Asian cuisine is soy sauce and miso and garlic and ginger and all of those great flavors that come together that just make you want to keep eating it. And you have the exact same types of, not the same flavors, but the same impact in Italian food with tomatoes and mushrooms and cheese and all of these rich, really savory flavors that are very, very appealing. And there's a lot of pasta in Italian food. There's a lot of pasta in Asian food. There's just a lot of really great similarities. And I think if you like one, you probably tend to like the other as well.
You think Marco Polo had something to do with it? I did think your explanation of how oyster sauce was invented.
I like that.
Was very good, and you like fish sauce.
Oh, with yeah. Red Boat, which is our favorite.
Yeah, we have a large container of Red Boat that is perfect for adding salt. When Anne says it needs a little more salt, I don't put salt in. I put Red Boat.
So great.
But there's an Italian.
Yeah,
fish sauce as well.
Yeah,
what's it called?
Interesting.
Yeah, what's it called?
It's made out of marinated anchovies.
It's anchovies.
Oh no way! I had no idea.
Oh yeah, wow. Same concept.
It's the same idea. It's not quite as primitive in the way that it's made. But.
Sure.
So now, which of these recipes? I'm looking for you to run through a couple of recipes to give the our listeners might find surprising and to pique their interest in getting a book that goes a little further than most Chinese food. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the recipes that one of the recipes that I think kind of typifies Myers and Chang is the panko crusted lemon chicken. Christopher grew up eating lemon chicken,
yes,
which I didn't know what that was, and he got it once for takeout, and I was shocked, honestly. I was like, how can you eat this? It was so sweet and bright and kind of just, I don't know, very foreign to anything I had ever eaten. But I knew how much he loved that whole general flavor of chicken and lemon and bright and sweet. So we took that idea and played around with it and created our own version, and it's fabulous. It's a chicken breast that's pounded and marinated, and then we fry it with a little bit of panko crumbs, which are a Japanese breadcrumb.
Yeah.
Very, very crunchy, very crispy. And then we serve it with a little candied lemon sauce over a bed of rice with some watercress. It's really simple, very easy to prepare, very delicious, really light, even though it's fried. And I think it's such a great example of what you can do with maybe an old Chinese food favorite that you had, and if you update it and make it more kind of yours, then that's something that I think people would really love to make.
In the Australian version, they pour in a ton of cornstarch.
It gets
the awful glassy look to it.
Yeah, I mean, we use a little bit of cornstarch in some of the recipes, but it's not really something I'm fond of. I don't know, I'm just not really into that. Then we also have, I mean, one of my favorite dishes is the pan-roasted soy glazed salmon.
Oh, yes.
This was something, that I grew up with. My mom would make it all the time. I made it for Christopher all the time when we were dating. And it's just, at this point, I've fallen so in love with making salmon this way that when we go out to eat, I don't ever order salmon. It's one of my favorite foods, but I've realized that when I eat salmon that's prepared any other way, I'm rarely happy because I miss this version. And it's just very simple, pan-seared, and then it's finished off with some soy and some rock sugar, some sriracha, a little ginger. It's really, really delicious, and then you finish it off in the oven. You serve it with some cucumbers and some cilantro that have been quick pickled. Maybe, again, serve it over rice, and then you have a great dinner. I mean, there's so many recipes in this book that you can just, you know, go to the store, buy all the ingredients, and then that night you have this amazing dinner that tastes like it came from a restaurant, because honestly, all of these recipes are direct from our recipe book in the restaurant.
Well, I'm going to hold you to that one, Joanne.
Yeah, we had salmon. We had salmon last night, and so we won't have salmon again until next week. But I'll make it next week. I promise.
Oh, good.
Thank you. Oh, I'm so glad. I can't wait to hear what you think of it. I love that recipe so much.
And you have a number of things with black bean sauce. I mean, that you put black beans in anything, and I'm happy.
We do. There's a clams with black bean sauce.
That's what I was looking at
in the book. Yeah, it's very, again, very simple. We tried really hard not to make the recipes full of ingredients that you'd have to spend a lot of time shopping for. And so, you know, clams, some black beans, a little ginger, a little garlic, and you can just make this really straightforward, really delicious, addictive dish that, you know, you take that sauce and you put it over rice and you could just eat that all day long.
We interviewed an Indian writer of an Indian cookbook. She's Indian, and her husband's Indian, and she modified traditional recipes once he got type 2 diabetes, and she said that India, which I never knew. I mean, she made these healthier and, you know, and eliminated some of the carbs and stuff, but she said that India is the diabetes capital of the world.
Oh, my.
And
I know that.
Yeah, she made it sound like it was rice and bread. But, I mean, you eat a lot of rice, and China is certainly not the diabetic capital of the world.
Yeah, there's a huge increase. There's been a big spike in the last decade or so, maybe even more, of Asians with diabetes. And they're not really sure what that's due to. I don't think it's because of the rice. I worry that it might be due to Asian constitutions that are not used to the types of foods in America. So I don't know if your friend was talking about Indians in India or
no,
in America.
No, she was living in California, but she was born and raised, she and her husband, in India. And he contracted diabetes. And so when she started cooking for him, she was trying to modify, and she claimed she actually made it controllable, the diabetes, without injections by the special diet.
Yeah, if you're interested, it's called Deepa's Secret.
Deepa.
D-E-E-P-A apostrophe S, Secrets.
Yeah.
Got it.
So who knows? But, I mean, I've never encountered a lot of diabetes in Chinese populations. I don't know. Well, I'm, as I said, I'm going to hold you to this because you see Peter's already picking out dishes that maybe wants to have. And
no, I'm going to cook it.
You're going to cook it.
Yeah.
Right? And
that's even more of a voluntary nature.
And we'll post it, the results on social media, Joey.
Oh, that would be great. I would love that. I would love to see that.
Only if it's successful.
It will be, I promise.
Otherwise, it'll be, you won't believe this, but.
Oh, dear. Joanne, continued much success. You sound like you're happy and content, and things are rolling along nicely, and everybody in your restaurant seem to be having fun.
Here's what you need. Here's the last piece of advice. You need to get in touch with Danny Meyer of Union Square Hospitality Group in New York City and find out who his investment banker is. because you're chasing Shake Shack in terms of the number of establishments, and he spun that business out into a separate company and pocketed $300 million.
Yeah,
man,
wow.
He did, right?
So if you need a couple of hundred million, you know where to go, and I'm sure he'd be delighted to put you in touch with the right people.
And
in the meantime, keep up the great work. It's always such a delight to talk to you, Joanne. And please say hello.
Thank you.
Please say hello to Chef Chris. And I love his vocabulary.
I will tell him.
Bye bye. Joanne.
Thank you.
Yeah, no,
thank
I mean,
so
about the time where I got to the point about how your kitchen crew was a randy bunch. I said, this isn't Joanne.
No, that's
dear.
All Christopher.
Yeah. All right, dear. Thank you so much. I wish we could into you. But you're so busy in Boston, I guess. Right?
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyhow, we'll talk to you with your next book.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you so
much. You'll hear from us about these recipes.
Wonderful. I can't wait.
Thanks, Joanne.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And now here's one of our favorite characters with a capital C.
No question about that.
It's Myron Mixon, who is the king of barbecue. Here he's talking on behalf of the Maple organization, whatever.
Well they were actually organizing the event that he's cooking.
He likes the barbecue with Maple, a great American flavor.
We never did, by the way, find out if he won. But he does win a lot, so my guess is that he probably did.
Oh, right. Actually, he was asking for recipes. We never found out about that either.
There's a website you can send them to. It's in the recording.
Never checked that.
All you have to do is
listen to the recording. Well, he talks about it, I guess.
It's up there in the description of the program as well. But he was kind of laid back because he'd been cooking all day, and he was just calling in from the field just because he didn't have anything else to do.
Yeah, he has more knowledge about barbecue than, I mean, it's just amazing. He's an encyclopedia for a mind here. Talking to Myron Mixon is always fun as well as informative. And today, I guess, Myron, we're going to talk to you about, you're representing, what's it called, the Maple Syrup Guild?
The Maple Guild Syrup.
Of Vermont only, huh?
Of Vermont only.
Right. Well, there's a lot of it there.
There's a pile of it up there. And the thing about it is, when you speak about Vermont and as far as maple syrup, it is the king.
Well, you know, I mean, there's so much artisanal product coming out of Vermont that I'm just amazed. Every time I look at the new product and look at where it's coming from is Vermont. They must have a good time up there, huh?
Oh, yes, they have. And the thing about it is that maple syrup, is not just used now for your pancakes and biscuits. I mean, as a barbecue guy, barbecue competitor, I've been using maple syrup in my sauces for competition since 1996. I've got it in my rubs, too. I've got the maple sugar powder. That's in some of my rubs I use for competition.
Okay, so the difference between those is the sauce is a liquid. And the rub is a solid, dry
rub. But it's the flavor of the maple syrup that everybody loves. And whenever you got that 100% pure syrup, like I use in my sauces, it makes a big difference. It's not like that, the light corn syrup you find on the shelf that everybody associates. That really is not maple syrup. There's not even any maple syrup in it. It's just flavored. But everything that I use is 100% maple syrup.
Yeah, I mean, there's such a difference. I really think that somebody should insist that people who pour those things out of those little bottles shaped like bears should actually taste the real stuff.
Exactly right. And I can tell you this, when I'm picking out maple syrup, I go for that light. I want the lightest maple syrup I can get because it's got the best flavor, doesn't have that burnt taste. It's smooth in my sauces. Complements the meat really well when I'm using it on my barbecue.
Now, just for information purposes, for our listeners who didn't hear the program we did about Vermont maple syrup, one of the things the Maple Guild does, I think you said earlier on, is they actually set the standards for the different grades, which are actually, in fact, are different colors. So
exactly right. So I think you got they are the darker. The darker syrups are they're a little bit stronger.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and that's more what you put on your pancakes, right?
I like to put the light on my pancake.
Oh, okay.
I've been to Vermont visiting, and I went to some of the sugar houses, and I like the light.
Uh-huh.
I like that light.
Now, they've been doing a big push promoting maple syrup, of course. And you know, I said, though, that I've noticed that it's really moving into big-time replacement for, at this time of year, it was always pumpkin, pumpkin, pumpkin. And now it's always maple, maple, maple. I mean, why is this?
Well, I think, you know, to me, I think maple syrup isn't just a regional thing. At one time, maple syrup was just about the Northeast. But it's like barbecue. Barbecue used to be a Southern thing, but now it's all over the country. Well, maple syrup now has moved and migrated all over our country. And everybody loves that taste.
Uh-huh.
And when fall weather gets around, especially when you're making candies and stuff like that, for the holidays, you know, a lot of those candies and stuff are made from pure 100% maple syrup. So I think that's why you're seeing some of the pumpkins get replaced by things made out of maple syrup.
Right.
Now, Myron, you're talking to us about this as you're like a sponsor or an expert or a judge of some kind of taste competition?
Well, I'm kind of like a sponsor of it. I mean, because
okay.
I have been using maple syrup a long time for my barbecue competition. Also, my dad down south, we don't have any maple trees, but he's always made cane syrup. So I know a little bit about how to make the syrups out here. But I can tell you, my favorite is maple syrup, a lot better over cane syrup, a little too strong.
Oh, yeah.
But is there an actual competition
going
on?
Yes, there's a recipe competition.
Oh, okay, got it.
We got a reputation. That's exactly right. We got a recipe competition. Matter of fact, we want all of our listeners to send in their best maple syrup recipe. Actually, I posted up my first one that I've got on the website now, my maple grilled peaches. Is on the website now, the recipe for it.
Yeah, so where do people send their entry? That's important, right?
Yes.
Go ahead.
They go to the Maple Guild, to their website.
Which is?
That'd be where they send in their entries.
Okay. And what's the timetable on this?
Hello?
Hello?
Let me look right here right quick, and I can give you the timetable.
Sure, thank you.
All for the month of November.
Okay, all right.
So we'll get this out then.
But you better start perfecting your recipe. Now, are you allowed to enter, Myron, or are you just a judge?
No, well, got me. I came up with four great recipes that where I'm using maple syrup, and I'm posting them kind of to give folks an idea of what they can do. Like my maple grilled peaches. I took Georgia peaches. I took the maple syrup.
Oh, that's good.
Well, we grilled them off. We made a reduction with the maple syrup and some dark rum. It's awesome.
Oh, it sounds good. And is this on the Guild's website?
Correct. It's on their website.
And so could you give us that address?
I believe it is www.mapleguild.com.
Okay. Sounds good. Now, since we have you on the phone, I just wanted our listeners to understand, you are a big-time barbecue
expert.
Winner. Winner, not just a participant. But
great. I'm the winningest man at barbecue. I've won 4 world championships.
What does it take to win a world's championship?
Well, I had to beat 276 folks every time I won it.
Now, is that the one that's sponsored by Jack Daniels?
No, that's the one hosted by the Memphis in May at Memphis.
Okay. Now, I thought the reason I asked is we interviewed 2 chefs from Boston who actually won the Jack Daniels competition.
All right.
Well, I've been there. I've reserved Grand the Jack Daniels before, but Jack Daniels has about 60 teams. The Memphis in May event has 276 teams.
I see. That's a big competition.
That is a huge competition, right on the Mississippi River.
Oh, wow. So, anything new in the pitmaster world?
He's doing a tasting, right? You're doing a tasting right now, right?
Well, we're getting ready to compete. I'm here in Mount Pleasant, Tennessee, doing a contest. We just got here around lunchtime. We're prepping our meat, getting ready for the contest tomorrow.
Here's a funny thing for you, Myron. We have a friend who's a cereal restaurateur here in our home city of Pittsburgh, and he decided he wanted to make the right kind of barbecue, so he bought himself
a Texas built custom
custom smoker. And when he got it, he liked it so much he ordered another one.
But he does, his big thing is brisket, and he does Texas style barbecue.
Well, I like Georgia-style barbecue.
Well, that's always a debate, isn't it? I mean, but
well, the thing about it is now, y'all remember the original 13 colonies, don't you? Well, Texas wasn't one right. of them, but Georgia was, so we were first.
Yeah, well, he went and studied the stuff at Franklin Barbecue in Austin.
Right.
And said, I can do that, and boy, is it good, I have to tell you.
Now, you've got to watch out for this Georgia right now. We have some very strange candidates for the U.S. Congress. I hope you're not supplying barbecue to him.
I tell you what, I kind of stay out of politics.
Yeah, well, but now's a good time to do that, right?
I just stay out of it altogether and try to stay under the radar.
Yeah, well, it's almost impossible to shake, though, at this point, I guess.
Ladies and gentlemen, listeners across the world, Myron Mixon is anything but under the radar when it comes to the world of barbecue. Why don't you finish us out the interview with your own website so that people can follow what you're up to and...
They can follow me. Go to MyronMixon.com. That takes you right to my website and to my store. Lets you know about my cook classes. And it lets you know where I'm competing at next. I got a restaurant now in Old Town Alexandria right outside of D.C.
Oh, my.
Called Myron Mixon.
Yes, yeah, called Myron Mixon Pitmaster Barbecue. I'm up there about 10 days a month. And I'd love for everybody to come by and see me there.
That's good news. Any other news like that? That was good.
Well, no other news like that. We have Mohegan Sun, the casino and the tribe up there in Connecticut. I partnered up with them. I'm doing some. I'm doing some barbecue pellets with them. We're doing them out there, getting them out there. The Myron Mixon wood pellets for the wood pellet smokers. So I got a lot of stuff going on right up there in the Northeast with y'all.
You always do, Myron, and it's always good to talk to you. Well, everybody get your recipes lined up and send them in early in November if you possibly can.
Now, we're, get everybody to send them in, and I wish everybody good luck. And keep watching on the website, maplegill.com, and they'll be posting up recipes that I've done. Kind of give y'all some ideas and send y'all in.
Good work, Myron. Good talking to you again.
It's good talking to y'all.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Where they say time flies when you're having fun. I just realized this is our last program in November. Next program is December, and pretty soon it's going to be Christmas. My goodness gracious me.
Right.
Oh, dear. But nevertheless, we'll still be here. We hope you'll be here, too. Same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.